Okay. If a day is raised.
Eleanor was a very bright woman. I think she was educated as a chemist, but she did not. She was not a career woman. She stayed home with the three kids, Ronald, Raymond, and Irene, none of whom I've seen for at least 50 years now. But was a very bright woman. My mother loved her. did the beehive thing in the backyard, but also but had cats. And when the cats would have litters, she would put the kittens in a picnic basket and tie either a pink ribbon or a blue ribbon, based on sex, and then she would walk over to the North Bridge, which is a big deal here in town, and she would give away the cats on sunny Sunday days out of the picnic basket. It always worked. So those were our closest connections to Concord were the Boudets, who my mother visited constantly, or Eleanor would come over to our house. I loved that about the cats, or the kittens. And then watching the utter destruction of the storefront at Vanderhoof's Hardware. And I can't, to this day, I can't spell Vanderhoof. Sorry. But I can drive you by, could copy it off the, which I presume they put the glass back in place.
But, so, it sounds as though hockey was your major subject, though, was it? Both to play it,
yeah,
and to write about
My dream in journalism was to cover the Red Sox and do baseball.
Do baseball.
And I was very fortunate to be doing it very young. I was a Red Sox beat guy by the age of 24, 25. It was... I won't tie up the evening here talking about what I think of baseball reporting is, but I generally term it a mental illness. Just because, and there are many reasons for that, but mostly because it's every day. And especially around here, it's every day when, in the only days we have good weather. So, but a long story short, I was very young. I was put on it at what was the Boston Herald American. And there were two older veteran guys who did not like it. Oddly, I think they liked me. I may be wrong about that. But they greatly resented me because they were very territorial. That was the thing to do in town, was to be the Red Sox. If you worked for a newspaper, the crowning achievement was to be a Red Sox beat person. I'll make a very long story short here. The sports editor who hired me ostensibly to be this young guy on the Red Sox, he was fired pretty quickly. He was fired within a couple of years. So they put a new sports editor in charge who was pals with the two cronies who were on the beat. And I hesitate to say cronies because I did like them both, but it was ugly, some of what they were doing, basically to sabotage me. So the sports editor hired me got fired, Rick Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S. Milt Greenglass, just the way it's spelled, he got put in as the sports editor. And within about 4.5 minutes, I was off the Red Sox and assigned to the Bruins, which I was crestfallen, to say the least, and very hurt by it. But turned out to be a wonderful thing for me because I also, other than baseball, hockey was my favorite sport. And the truth of it is, to this day, it's a great sport to write, but it was also a great sport to report because access was terrific. It was quite good then in baseball, access to players. The problem with the players in baseball, and they're truer today, if you will, they're really jerks. Whereas the hockey guys were good guys. It was a humbling sport. if one thing true of sports journalism is usually the more humbling the sport, the better the athlete. So players who get beaten up routinely are usually very good guys to deal with. Football players, boxers, mixed martial artists. Not that I'm much of a UFC guy, but sports where people routinely get their head beat in are usually good guys. And hockey is less that sport today. Hockey, when I covered it, it was riddled with fighting and brawling, what we call buckets of blood. There were routinely both benches would empty. They'd beat each other up on the ice. They'd carry it into the hallway. They'd beat each other up. And I loved it. Loved it. I have subsequently become a proponent of abolishing fighting entirely in the sport. But I can tell you, even though I write it all the time, I am a proponent, I believe it, it shouldn't be in the game for lots of reasons, I still love a good fight. I have to admit that. I know that's a contradiction, but I think that's just human nature. I think people like to see people fighting, especially when they're not one of the people.
But somehow you're equating that the fight, the brawl with some of the best guys?
Yeah. So again, football, boxing, I just believe that it's because they're always in this danger business or danger zone that dealing with us is nothing, you know? And typically it should be nothing. You know, there's really nothing to fear.
Now, dealing with us reporters?
Yeah. Now, and that said, there are extremely incompetent people in my business. There are. There are bad writers. You know, what we say of bad writers sometimes is that they can't write home for money. But I can also tell you that there are bad writers who are excellent reporters, who are great competitors. Their words get to the desk. They're barely decipherable sometimes, but they're good. They're valuable. They're valuable to departments. So there's a lot of things you can be in my business. A good writer isn't necessarily going to carry the day. You can be a good reporter. You can be great about detail, which is reporting. You can have, most of all, great news judgment. In the end, you're not a good writer, but it almost doesn't matter. No, it's not even almost. It doesn't matter.
Great news judgment.
No, what is a story? What is a story, right? Go into a locker room. I tell kids all the time that what ends up making or breaking you in this business isn't necessarily your ability to use words or even tell the story. It's to be able to walk into a dressing room and to know who's lying and why are they lying. You know, are they lying to protect themselves? Are they lying for someone else? Because there's a lot of lying, accepted lying in our business. And you just have to be able, it's difficult, but you know, it becomes sort of a sixth sense to decipher who's telling, if not who's lying, who's really telling you the truth or who's telling you the real truth. That becomes critical.
And by this time you've had enough experience both playing sports and reporting them to be able to assess that pretty well.
You hope so.
An authentic assessment anyway.
Yeah. I mean, what I tell kids all the time is the most important thing you are is right. Because if you're wrong enough, they'll get somebody else. It's great to turn in great prose. It's great to think or believe or even demonstrate that you have news judgment. But if in the end, with all those, if you've got good words, if you've got good news judgment, if what you write is wrong, then you're out of work. You have to be right. Everybody's wrong sometimes. But you have to build enough pennies to the right side of things to be able to weather the storm of being wrong. Yeah, exactly. Balance the book. know, and wrong is by being wrong. It's by missing a story. All of it's tolerable. But again, it's sports. None of us is launching the nuclear missile here. So even if you're wrong, it's almost so what. But I can tell you, there's the worst feeling in the business is being wrong. The times you're wrong stick with you far more than the day you won or the day you were right and everybody else was wrong. When you make a mistake, it hurts. And also, when you see that not bother people, typically they don't stay in the business long. Because I think you have to feel it. Because you don't get rich in this job. It isn't about the money. It really is about whatever it is. You know, as I explained, for me it was competition and feeling that I was delivering and beating people. For some people, they feel they're turning in beautiful prose. But ultimately, wherever you're finding your high in the business or whatever that reward is, you've got to be right far more than you're wrong. And by far more, I mean you've got to be right 90, 95% of the time.
Oh, this has been great.
I don't know. I don't think I've said much. I've talked a lot. I don't know if I've said much.
Is there anything else you want to...
Let's see. Well, I think we talked about the business, my family. No.
Well,
no.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I do have a question. Could you talk about changes to the built and social environment in Concord that you've seen over your life? And perhaps in athletics as well?
Concord Athletics, you're saying?
Could be.
Concord Athletics.
Changes in this town.
My closest association with sort of the social fabric of town is not through journalism but through my church. So I'm Catholic. When we moved to Concord, there were two Catholic churches in town. There's now only one. My wife and I, and when my son was born, we went to Our Lady's, which was over in West Concord. And in 2004, that church was closed. And then there was the other church in town, which is the standing Catholic church, which is now Holy Family. At the time, it was known as St. Bernard's. But long story short, the archdiocese closed both and merged. They use different words, but that's what it was, a merger between the two standing Catholic churches. And now we are one Catholic church, Holy Family, right on Monument Square, an iconic building, and a beautiful church. Excuse me. So because I don't work in town and my son only went to public school for K through 3 before he started going to a private school in town, the Fenn School, and then ultimately Concord Academy across the street. Really, our connectedness to the town socially has been the church in many ways, in many different capacities. So I trying to really glean how this town has changed in the 20 years that I've lived here, I might not have a really clear or fair view of that because I'd be viewing it through the prism of two churches that closed and the incredibly parallel universe that is the Catholic Church and mainstream print journalism. They're both collapsing for different reasons. But it seems to me, seeing it through the church lens and also just seeing it as through the taxpayer lens, the greatest change has been the cost of housing and the cost of living here, which was high anyway when we got in 20 years ago, but it is so exorbitantly high now that lower and middle income families can't afford to live here. The elderly can't afford to live here. So when you take out those large segments of the socioeconomic network, you begin to see sort of a sterilization of who lives here, or homogenization. And the homogenization is younger, rich, high income, high capacity in terms of being able to spend. And that definitely permeates, I think, every part of the town. I think it shows up in what stores open, what stores close, the new housing stock. You know, there's, and this is true in much of America, but, you know, if I drove you around town, you would see 1940s, 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s, subdivisions of homes that were built anywhere from, say, 1,400 or 1,800 square feet. Many of them Cape Cod-style homes, single-level ranch homes, split levels, what were called acorn houses. None of these houses would exceed 2,000 square feet. Well, now no one's building a house here less than 3,500 square feet. And nothing 3,500 square feet or above is less than $1 million. So, that changes everything. You know, the town I grew up in and talked about earlier in Bedford, where we threw our glove on our bicycle and went up to the corner and played ball, that doesn't exist. Those kids all go to camps. And I guess the word that comes to my mind, and at the risk of offending whoever's listening, is that there's been a professionalization of the citizenry. That it is exceedingly and progressively white collar. And I miss the blue-collar edge. I have to believe, you know, if we define blue-collar as, I have to be careful here, firefighters, police, town workers, teachers, I can't believe any of them can afford to live here.
Many of them don't.
Yeah. And, of course, I grew up in an era when in a lot of these towns you had to hold those jobs, you had to live in that town. If you were a policeman in Bedford, you had to live in Bedford. If you were a teacher, that all began to change in the 60s and 70s. This isn't unique to Concord. This is true of many of the, if you will, tonier suburbs around Boston. But I can tell you I really miss that part of connectedness to the town where, and of course these don't even exist anymore, but as a kid we went to the local little grocery store that was run by the Stefanellis, and the Gilmans ran the Bedford Butcher Market. Well, those stores don't even exist anymore, but what was nice is when you walked into those stores, you knew them and they knew you. You know, they knew your first name, they knew your mother and father. You know, your dad was just here. I'm sure my son has never been in a store in Concord where they said your mom or dad were just here. They wouldn't know who anybody is. So that to me, I'm sure if you got people who, if I got the Blade kids that I mentioned who grew up on Martin Road in the in the 50s and 60s, they could probably tell you that same story. So, you know, Concord has, to its, I think, credit, tried to, through zoning, keep out chain stores. We do have a CVS. What else do we have in that vein? Nothing's coming to mind here. But, there is not. There is a Cumberland Farm at the gas station. So, but they have tried to keep it kind of that Americana version. But it Vanderhoof's Hardware may be a good example, even though there is an Ace Hardware.
Even if you can't spell it.
Even if you can or can't spell it, exactly. On the sports scene in town, I think it's developed, from my eye, it's held on to its traditions in terms of not that I could recite you their state titles, but typically does extremely well in youth in high school soccer, football decent. Tennis, excellent. And I would say
hockey.
That if hockey, okay. Yeah. Not great. Lacrosse, improving. That's something that's really in the last 10 to 12 to 15 years, statewide, has the emphasis on lacrosse, boys and girls, has grown dramatically. To the detriment of baseball, because it's played in the spring. Many kids now don't look at baseball or softball because lacrosse is far more popular, got a lot more action. And kids, I think, feel far more vital, even if they're not producing. But if you're running around with a stick in your hand, there's a feeling of vitality in that, and you're really in it. Whereas if you're playing right field in baseball, you ain't in it. Football does a great job at that. That's an ethos of football at whatever level, is no matter what position you play, coaches typically make you feel important, because you're 1 of 11 on defense, you're 1 of 11 on offense. This team doesn't perform unless you're performing at whatever narrow definition of, or broad definition of, your role is. But that's one thing about baseball, and this isn't just Concord, of course. This is every town. This is at every level, be it high school, college. It's difficult getting Americans to engage in the game now, both from a recreational standpoint of playing it and also from observing it, just because there is so much downtime in it. It's still a beautiful game. There's so much strategy and there's so much to think about during the game, even though maybe nothing's happening. But I don't see where we're a society right now that appreciates the kind of the undercurrent of the intellectual stimulation of a game. People want to run around with a stick in their hand. Of course, I've spent most of my life covering a sport where people race around with a stick in their hand chasing 4 ounces of rubber, so what do I know?
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, laughing and crying. Yeah. That sounds like victory.
Yeah.